If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There's accounts of him beating Cromwell up on a regular basis and treating him like a dog. And yet, Cromwell's loyalty never wavers from Henry.
That was Tracy Borman on the often tumultuous relationship between Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell.
We lost a few men, and you could hear the roaring water about 20 or 30 feet below, the river rushing by, and we lost a few men down, fell over.
Oh, and people actually fell in?
Yes, fell in from the plank.
And that was First World War veteran William Holbrook, describing his experiences of September 1914. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your App Store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. First up this week, we're talking about Thomas Cromwell. Born to a lowly family in Putney in the late 15th century, Cromwell went on to become one of the most powerful men in Tudor England, second only to the king. But who was the real Cromwell, and what caused Henry VIII to condemn his one-time favourite to the executioner's block? Our features editor Charlotte Hodgman met up with historian Tracy Borman at Hampton Court Palace to find out more about the highs and lows of Henry's henchmen.
Thomas Cromwell, how did he actually become Henry's right-hand man in the first place?
It was really a tale of rags to riches with Thomas Cromwell. He was the son of a blacksmith. He had a very hard upbringing. There's hints of violence on the part of his father. There's even rumours that Cromwell was in prison for a while, and it's been speculated that that's perhaps why he took himself off to the continent. He certainly seemed to have left England in a hurry when he was still a teenager. Yeah. And so he really came from, you know, just this total opposite background to the vast majority of Henry's court. The only other precedent was Thomas Wolsey, Cardinal Wolsey, who was the son of a butcher and became Cromwell's first master, really. I think that was a meeting of minds there.
Yeah.
And it was certainly Wolsey's patronage that was largely it was certainly Wolsey's patronage that was Cromwell could draw on, really, in paving his way to the court of Henry VIII. And he used his contacts well. Wolsey introduced Cromwell to many important figures at court and, of course, to the king himself.
Yeah.
But I think Cromwell's main advantage was his sheer ability. I think he was borderline genius. He taught himself law. He taught himself several languages. He just seemed to have this huge brain, this huge capacity for knowledge. And he had this even bigger ambition, and those two things combined to devastating effect.
Yeah. And do you think Henry saw that early on?
I think Henry certainly spotted Cromwell's potential very early.
Yeah.
Because Cromwell was fighting against all the odds when he first really made his entree into the court was 1529, when he was closely associated with the man who'd just fallen from favour, Cardinal Wolsey. Nobody could have expected Cromwell to succeed. In fact, he was probably expected to go the same way as his master. And yet he not only managed to pave his own way in that court, but he won back Henry's favour for Wolsey, albeit in some degree, not a total reclaim of favour so that Wolsey was reinstated. But certainly he made Henry think benevolently towards the cardinal again.
And what sort of man was he? He's quite a hard man to kind of know what he was like, isn't he? Because you say he was borderline genius. But what was he like as a person?
I think Cromwell's been really wrongly portrayed until recent years with the renaissance he's enjoyed thanks to Hilary Mantel. He's been seen as a humourless bureaucrat,
yeah.
One of the typical villains of history. He masterminds the dissolution of the monasteries, and he cold-heartedly puts Anne Boleyn to death. He had such a different character, I think, to that. Certainly he was ruthless, certainly he was ambitious, but he was also funny, he was irreverent, he was highly intelligent. He had this sense of not being afraid of authority, and just appealing to the human side of people in authority. So, for example, when he wanted something from the Pope, he gave him sweets because he knew the Pope had a sweet tooth. And he won people round in surprising little ways like that. And I think I totally warmed to him when I was doing my research.
Certainly not the idea that you say has been portrayed of him before. He's been, you know, I always think he's been quite cold and, you know, humourless.
Absolutely. And that side has come through very strongly. And certainly he was ruthless when he needed to be. But then this was a dog-eat-dog world, the Tudor court. If you weren't ruthless, you wouldn't survive.
Yeah.
Certainly you wouldn't survive in any powerful capacity. And Cromwell undoubtedly wanted power. So he had to fight fire with fire in that way. But he did have this softer side to him. He had very close friends who he was very loyal to. He was very, very loyal and loving towards his family too. And I think that's what Hilary Mantel really draws out in her novels to very credible effect, actually.
Do we know what his contemporaries thought of him?
Yeah, the opinion is quite widely divided among contemporaries, and his friends literally don't have a bad word to say about him. They praise his loyalty, his steadfastness, the fact that he'll do anything for them. And you get a sense that his son in particular really loved him, really looked up to him. But his enemies can't think of a good word to say about him. I think the character who most interests me in terms of his descriptions of Cromwell was Eustace Chapuys, the imperial ambassador, because he was a natural enemy of Cromwell, but he can't help himself. I think he kind of liked him.
Yeah.
And so he does admit that, you know, Cromwell could just hold everybody's attention rapt when he was telling a joke, or that he threw a great party, he was a brilliant host. And so I think his descriptions are probably the most accurate, because you get the good and the bad.
And would you say it was a friendship between him and Henry, as well as a kind of, you know, political and, you know, a power type thing?
Do you know, I don't think it ever quite was. It certainly not in the way that Henry VIII related to Cardinal Wolsey. I think he trusted Wolsey a lot more. I think there was a companionship that you don't sense in the same way with Cromwell. And I think Henry had his fingers burnt by Wolsey and would never quite trust a so-called low-born minister in the same way as he did Wolsey. That said, Cromwell took risks in his relationship with Henry. He told Henry hard truths that other courtiers wouldn't dare. And you get the feeling that he was a lot more frank, a lot more open with Henry, and didn't always just play the courtier with him.
Yeah. The break with Rome and the dissolution of the monasteries is probably one of his high points for Cromwell, wasn't it? How much power did he actually have at this point?
Cromwell was all powerful at that stage. The opinions divided as to how soon he conceived the idea of the Reformation in its totality, including the dissolution of the monasteries. Undoubtedly, other minds contributed to that, but Cromwell was the one with the vision and with the audacity to take it forward. And when the Reformation was at its height in the late 1530s, certainly from 1536 onwards, Cromwell was all powerful. There's quote after quote from different ministers, from different ambassadors, basically saying he is the number one man at court, you know, second only to the king, and some even rumoured he had his eyes on the throne himself, although I think we can discount that.
And his relationship with Anne Boleyn has also been quite well documented. Did he really sort of mastermind her demise? Did he really hate her that much?
I think the relationship between Cromwell and Anne Boleyn was fascinating. They were allies for quite a long time. They certainly shared a love of the reformed religion. And Cromwell put Anne on the throne, there's no doubt about it. He was the one who finally secured the divorce from Catherine of Aragon for Henry, which of course brought Anne to power. But their relationship did break down. And I think what Cromwell realised that was that he was backing the wrong horse. When Anne failed to give Henry the son that he craved, her star was falling at court. Cromwell could no longer associate himself with her. And it was also, there's a sense of it's a battle to the death. I think it was almost Cromwell's neck or hers. She openly threatened him. She said she would like to see his head off his shoulders. And so it wasn't a sort of unprovoked attack on his part. I think he was fighting for survival.
So why was she against him? What happened, you know, what happened to cause her to hate him?
I think it's really interesting because I think one of the main reasons was that she felt that the Reformation was going too far and it was becoming too much about profit. So she agreed with the dissolution of the monasteries, but she thought that the profits ought to be diverted to charitable causes, to setting up new foundations, rather than just swelling the royal coffers. So that was certainly a point of contention. But also, I think she realised that Cromwell wasn't an unquestioned supporter of her, that he wasn't going to be with her through thick and thin, that he was just there for as long as she was powerful and then he would desert her. And so she set out to mastermind his downfall. And it was really who could get there first. And I do think it was thanks to Cromwell that Anne was executed. There are many different theories about Anne's downfall, but you can certainly see the paths and the sort of the tangled web, if you like, that he wove to entrap Anne.
Yeah, yeah. And at what point would you say that Henry's high opinion of Cromwell started to wane?
I think it was quite late in the day, because even in April 1540, so a mere 2 months before Cromwell's arrest, he was made an earl. He was made Earl of Essex. He was given great honour at court. And ambassadors suddenly reported, you know, Cromwell's star is on the rise again. It's all looking favourable for him. And then suddenly, and it was so sudden, the 10th of June, the Privy Council meets, Cromwell arrives late, and he's immediately arrested. And you get the sense of shock from Cromwell. Even just, I was looking at letters that he wrote just hours before that. There's no indication that he knew what was going to come.
He didn't see it coming.
No. He didn't see it coming. And Cromwell knew everything that was going on at court. So I think it was certainly a conspiracy by Cromwell's enemies, notably Stephen Gardiner, Bishop of Winchester, and also the Duke of Norfolk. I think Henry himself still retained quite a lot of affection for Cromwell, but he was persuaded against him by this conspiracy.
Do you think that had been ha- happening for some weeks beforehand, even though Cromwell wasn't aware of that.
I think this power struggle between those two big rival factions, Cromwell on the one hand and Gardiner and Norfolk on the other, that had been going on for years, not just weeks. And Cromwell had always just about managed to get the upper hand, although what Norfolk in particular had over him was that he was blue-blooded. He was of noble stock, and he really used that with Henry. It's like, look, you can't trust these low-born ministers. Look what happened with Wolsey. And I think gradually that played on Henry's increasing paranoia. And then Cromwell arranges the disastrous marriage to Anne of Cleves. And that certainly doesn't help his cause towards the end.
Yes, I mean, Anne of Cleves, it wasn't his finest moment. Do you think he was surprised?
I think he was. I think he'd taken sort of the necessary precautions to ensure it would be a good match, in that he has sent Holbein over to take Anne's portrait so that Henry wasn't just marrying blindly. And it came back a very nice portrait, and Henry liked it very much. But I think Holbein has sort of flattered Anne. Although I think also that's been overplayed, that she was the ugly wife. She wasn't to Henry's taste, certainly. But there was as much about her manners and her sort of cultural achievements or lack of that really put Henry off. But I think Cromwell didn't give up on the marriage immediately. I think he'd certainly worked on Henry to try and like Anne a bit more, and he worked on Anne to try and please the king more.
Yeah.
But Henry, there was no going back for him. Once he'd met her, he shouted to Cromwell, "I like her not," and he wouldn't have anything to do with her after that.
Do we know what Cromwell thought of Anne himself?
No, we don't get a sense. I mean, he tries to praise her, you know, desperately sort of drawing on any virtues or kind of adornments that she had. But you do get the feeling that actually he knew he was onto a loser here, that he'd chosen the wrong bride. Absolutely. Yeah.
So how far do you think Cromwell's determination to push through religious reform contributed to his downfall?
I think Cromwell became more extreme in the cause of religious reform as his ascendancy progressed. He became perhaps a little too arrogant, perhaps a little out of touch with the mood of the people. But he had cause to be confident in Henry's support, because Henry had shown little sign of wavering. But Cromwell did become quite extreme towards the end, and really pushed through quite radical ideas. And Henry was clearly getting nervous at that stage. He was going too far, and he started to then lend a friendly ear to the conservative Catholics at court, Norfolk and Gardiner principal amongst them. And Cromwell should perhaps have taken more of a warning from that. I think he carried on regardless because he was confident he would win Henry round, whereas of course he didn't, and Henry was put off for good, really, and wanted to try and sort of conciliate with the Pope and with the Catholic powers of Europe.
I mean, Henry and Cromwell's relationship is quite a roller coaster one, you know, ups and downs. At the very end, was there anything that Cromwell could have done to have saved his neck, really?
I think Cromwell did everything possible. There's an agonising letter, or two letters, in fact, that he wrote to Henry from the Tower, where he's really writing to save his own neck. He's been asked to write to basically give evidence in supporting Henry's divorce from Anne of Cleves. So Henry's really wringing every last bit of service out of Cromwell. Even when he's in the Tower, he's making him write a letter that will help him get rid of Anne of Cleves. And Cromwell does that very dutifully. He puts all the blame on Anne, and you know she's clearly unsuitable as a wife. But then there's the desperate pleading of a doomed man. And it's heartbreaking reading that final letter that he writes to Henry, which is full of pleading and begging for forgiveness and saying what a wretched subject he is. And then, as if that isn't enough, he adds a desperate postscript in which he pleads for mercy, mercy, mercy. And you just know that's his last letter. And he, of course, doesn't get mercy. What we know is that Henry asked for that letter to be read to him three times. Now, it, of course, didn't do the trick, but I think the very fact he wanted to hear it suggests to me that it was on a knife edge as to whether he would pardon him. But in the end, I think just the critical voices of the likes of Norfolk and Gardiner persuaded Henry, you can't let Cromwell live.
Yeah, I mean, it is very reminiscent of Anne Boleyn, really, wasn't it? Mm. She was writing to him from the Tower, but
yes.
So you think Henry was really turned by the people around him?
I do. And I think he was naturally becoming more paranoid and suspicious as a king anyway, as he got into the latter part of his reign. So it was almost a sense of he didn't need much persuading. Yeah. And it was quite characteristic of him to show somebody great favour one minute and chop off their head the next. So Cromwell wasn't the only victim of that rather capricious king.
Yeah. And how did people react to his death?
There was opinion was divided about Cromwell's death. It's easy to say, oh, you know, everybody rejoiced. There was a quote about few lamented, but many rejoiced. But actually, I think that's slightly distorting the picture. Certainly, at court, many rejoiced. He had many powerful enemies at the heart of the court. And Henry VIII very callously marries Catherine Howard on the very same day as Cromwell's execution. So he seems not to give it a second thought. But the common people of London were apparently devastated because Cromwell had been very kind to them. He'd always had their interests at heart. He'd looked out for the merchants of London. He'd given very generously to the poor. And so it was recorded by several chroniclers that there was a sort of general groaning at his execution. The commoners, the common subjects of Henry VIII were genuinely grief-stricken at Cromwell's demise. And it's not long before Henry is too. Just a few short months later, he's lamenting the loss of the most faithful servant he ever had.
And blaming other people perhaps for making him
exactly.
Kill
Gardiner and Norfolk don't do too well after that. You know, no. Norfolk ends up in the Tower and so they fall from power because, yeah, Henry's looking for somebody to blame. He will never turn that blame on himself and realise that he shouldn't have got rid of the man who was unquestionably loyal. That's what Cromwell was to Henry throughout, no matter how badly Henry treated him. And there's accounts of him beating Cromwell up on a regular basis and treating him like a dog. And yet Cromwell's loyalty never wavers from Henry. I think he's the only person whose interest Cromwell valued more than his own.
It's very sad, isn't it, really?
It's incredibly sad.
I mean, was that because he genuinely felt affection for the king, or was it for his own gain, that loyalty?
I think that's an interesting question. Certainly, he always had an eye to his own career and his own security. But there's a sense that he genuinely loved Henry. He just wanted to serve him. He would take whatever Henry threw at him, and he did throw a lot during the course of his career at court. But there's never a sense that he was looking to the next monarch, or he was making alliances abroad, or anything that might suggest a slight wavering of loyalty to Henry. I think he sort of hero worshipped Henry to a certain extent.
I mean, how did Cromwell compare with Wolsey in his style of advising and, you know, as a person?
I think they were like two peas in a pod, really. They were from similar backgrounds, you know, and that was remarked upon a lot because that wasn't the usual route to court.
No.
You had to be born into it. And they were both very clever, very witty, very irreverent, you know, quite a disrespect for authority. And so they kind of won Henry over in that way. But I think Cromwell appreciated the difference being that Henry would never allow himself to get as close to anybody as he did to Wolsey. There was a respectful distance, I think, between Cromwell and Henry that hadn't existed between Henry and Wolsey.
And did he ever have anybody like Cromwell and Wolsey after they...
That was it. Mm. That was it, really. That, you know, there was a succession of different noblemen at court and different advisers, but there was never another Cromwell or another Wolsey. That was it as far as Henry was concerned. He just became increasingly paranoid, irascible, unpredictable, and right up to his final days. And nobody could judge which way he was going to go, but certainly there was nobody at court who would gain that same level of power.
How did Cromwell behave with his own family? What sort of man was he there?
You get the sense from the few letters that exist about Cromwell and his family that he was a very loyal husband, a very loving husband, actually, and loving father. But quite a lot of inference needs to be made, particularly with his relationship with his wife, Elizabeth, which has been portrayed as very affectionate, very close. But in fact, there isn't that much evidence of their relationship, full stop. There's one letter that survives that Cromwell wrote to his wife, and it's really a covering note because he's sending her a rather unusual gift, which is a dead deer that he has slaughtered on a hunt, and it's not even all for her, because he includes instructions for her to chop it up and give half to his friends.
Very romantic.
And so how romantic is that? But he does sort of address the letter to, you know, my well-beloved wife Elizabeth, although that was a common term of endearment in Tudor times. His relationship with his son, there's much more evidence of the closeness that exists, and many letters were exchanged with Gregory, and Cromwell certainly focused a lot on Gregory's education. And unusually, his two young daughters, who sadly died very early on in their life, Cromwell also invested in their education, and I think that's real credit to him as a father, because that certainly wasn't the norm. So overall, the picture is one of a man who was intensely loyal to his immediate circle, but obviously ruthless to quite a few others beyond that.
Why has he had that bad reputation until quite recently? What's caused that?
I think partly people have just neglected that other side, that other part of his life. They've focused on his public career, and that creates quite a one-dimensional character. This, as I mentioned, a sort of humourless bureaucrat who's just focused on business and quite cold and calculating, whereas in his more personal letters and correspondence, the other Cromwell, the witty, kind, loyal man, emerges so strongly, and I think is as significant. It's not to do with great state affairs, but it's about the man who ran those affairs, and so I think it deserves exploration, and that's certainly what I tried to do in my book.
That was Tracy Borman. Tracy's book, Thomas Cromwell, The Untold Story of Henry VIII's Most Faithful Servant, will be published next week in the UK by Hodder and Stoughton. And it should be available for the Kindle in the US at a similar time. Tracy has also written an article on Thomas Cromwell in the September issue of BBC History magazine, which is out now. Also this month, we explore Britain's plans to repel a Nazi invasion, a crisis in ancient Rome, and how the James Bond novels relate to Jamaican history. You can get hold of our September issue now in all good newsagents or as a digital edition. And if you're thinking of taking out a subscription, we are currently offering new UK subscribers 5 issues for just £5, but that is for a limited time only. Head to historyextra.com/subscribe to take advantage of that. And Tracy Borman is one of the speakers at this year's BBC History magazine History Weekend, which takes place in October in Malmesbury. There are still tickets available for some of the talks, and for details of that and to book tickets, please visit historyweekend.com.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
It's now time for the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarnan.
Queen Victoria had an affair with her Scottish servant, John Brown, new evidence suggests. Julia Baird, who was working on a biography of Queen Victoria, says she has found a record of a curious interaction between the pair in the diary of the monarch's trusted doctor, Sir James Reed. In an unpublished extract held by Reed's descendants, the doctor recalls how on Thursday, the 22nd of March, 1883, he opened the door to Victoria's room to find her flirting with John Brown as she walked a little. Brown says to her, lifting his kilt, "Oh, I thought it was here." She responds, lifting up her dress, "No, it is here." Writing for the New York Times, Baird says it is unclear from the note exactly what it might be, but that the diary entry reveals an extraordinary level of intimacy that exceeded not just what was normal for a lady and her servant, let alone a queen, but also for male and female friends. The nature of the relationship between Brown and Queen Victoria has long been debated by biographers. In other news, a medieval sword, possibly taken as a trophy during the 1066 Battle of Hastings, is due to go up for auction this week. The extremely rare broadsword belonged to Humphrey de Boon, a kinsman of William the Conqueror. The weapon has an earlier Viking blade, dating from the mid-11th century. Sir Humphrey fought at Hastings, where Christie's auctioneers believe he could have captured the sword, BBC News reports. The sword is expected to fetch up to £120,000 in the auction house's out-of-the-ordinary sale in South Kensington. Meanwhile, a heroic First World War horse has been presented posthumously with a so-called Animal Victoria Cross. Warrior, dubbed the horse the Germans could not kill, was awarded the honorary PDSA Dickin Medal at a special ceremony. The award is the first honorary PDSA Dickin Medal ever presented in the veterinary charity's 97-year history, in recognition of the bravery of millions of animals that served during the conflict, The Telegraph reports. The medal was accepted by author and broadcaster Bruff Scott MBE, grandson of Warrior's owner and rider, General Jack Seeley, at a special ceremony at the Imperial War Museum, London.
Thanks, Emma. As regular listeners will know, we like to read out messages that you've sent in to us on podcast@historyextra.com. And recently we were contacted by Christian Leo, who is listening in Santa Barbara. Christian writes, "I know it was back in May, but I download a set of your podcasts after I've listened to a bunch of others. That interview with Tim Butcher is the reason I enjoy listening to your podcasts. The way he delivers his knowledge about his book on Gavrilo Princip, the assassin charged with starting the First World War, makes history grippingly exciting." Thanks for your message, Christian. If anyone would like to listen again to that interview with Tim Butcher, it can be found in our episode from the 22nd of May, which is still available to download, as indeed are all our previous broadcasts. Now, since June this year, we've been running a series in the magazine entitled Our First World War, which recreates the events of 100 years ago through the voices of those who were there. And alongside that on the podcast, we've been regularly broadcasting some audio clips from interviews by the Imperial War Museum. For the latest issue, we've moved on to September 1914. Royal Fusilier William Holbrook had just finished the retreat from the Battle of Mons, and now he found himself attacking German positions close to the River Ain. Here he is describing attempts to cross that river.
"The Ain is a river, and a few yards further on is a canal. So you see, it's a canal, the river goodbye. So what the Germans done, they'd blown up the, they'd left the canal intact, the first of the canal, but blown up the bit over the river. It was very, very high. And what the engineers had to do, that's why we had to wait that night, was to throw a bridge as far as possible over from one side of the bridge out. They'd blown up. It's a distance of about, oh, I suppose it would be 10, 15 feet. It would have been blown up, hell of a job. And we had to cross, when they got there, we had to cross these planks. Next day, the next afternoon, it was a hell of a job. There's no railing. It's just bare planks, and they kept moving as you walked on them. There's no supporters. There's only this plank support for the whole of the length of this plank. There's nothing, just two planks together. I don't know how they got that. And as you put one foot down, it's dark, half dark, I don't know, as you put one foot down, you see, the weight of your body, the board, as you lift the foot, it sprang up and met the other foot before you could get it down to the ground. It was a hell of a job getting across. And we lost a few men, and you could hear the roaring water about, I was about 20 or 30 feet below, the river rushing by, and we lost a few men down, fell over.
Oh, and people actually fell in?
Yes, fell in from the plank. And we got across, and our colonel, I always remember the colonel, this one here, he stood the other side, he went across first. He stood the other side of the bridge and called about my name and helped him, that's what he got. And I remember saying to one man, there was a sergeant in front of me, his name was Jarvis, I remember now, and he's very, very timid. And I remember, as he went, he halted and stopped, and I gave him a bit down. He got across in the end. I heard the colonel say to him, "And what's your name?" He said, "Sergeant Jarvis." So, "Are you all right?" He said, "Yes." So we helped him over. Anyway, we got across. And by 12 o'clock, we'd taken over 800-900 men across the plank. Marvellous it was, really. So we got across the river.
They didn't run up a rope or something for you to hold on to as you went across them? They didn't put a rope or something like that?
No, nothing. It's only just all the planks supported by kind of boxes or something. There was no rope to hold on by. You said you walked on this plank. Yeah, hell of a job we were getting across. Anyway, you got across here, and there we...
You weren't under fire this time? You weren't under fire at all?
They were shelling a bit, not much, when these shells were coming over.
Back in Britain, the Home Front was gearing up to support the war effort, and one man involved in that was Joe Pickard from Northumberland. Here he recalls the building of a new army camp.
Then the army decided to open a big base depot, and it was built opposite the castle, where you could look down great, those open spaces, so they built a lot of huts there. And with being unemployed, and there wasn't any other sort of work, so I just took it in my head one morning, and I went down to see if I get a job. And I walked up to the big general foreman, God, he wrote twice the size of me. And I just asked him, I said, "Any chance of a job?" So he sort of looked us up and down, and I was about 5'7" or thereabouts then. And he said, "What can you do?" Well, I said, "Anything." He said, "All right, go across to the office and get a check out." So I started there on building these huts. And I was accepted by a joiner. He took me on as a sort of helper or apprentice. And he allowed me to use his tools and everything else. So I thought I was over the moon, because I always fancied a bit of woodwork.
What sort of huts were they building? Were they good, solid ones? Could you describe the construction?
It was all built with seasoned wood, not the stuff you get now. I mean, in latter years, they were fetching it straight off the boots. And, of course, it was soft, you see. But then it was all good wood. And, I don't know. There were roofs, you know, corrugated iron. That was the roofs. And there were stoves in the huts and everything like that. Well, of course, I don't suppose anybody knew much about that sort of thing. I mean, there was something brand new for everybody. A big war like that starting, nobody knew anything about it.
Did they have proper foundations?
I had to put the water in and all that sort of thing. And It's funny talking about foundations now. I mean, there was, had to put lavatories in and water drains were put in and all that sort of thing. The hut itself, I don't know how many it held, about maybe 20 or something like that. And an NCU in one end and a special little room in charge of the hut, you see, that sort of thing. And they were built all over the country.
And you were built, it was a standard design you were building?
Oh, yes, they were all the same thing. And there was four battalions of troops, full battalions of troops, were stationed down in what they call the pastures. There was one raised by the shipbuilders and the people on the Tyne, called the commercials, and they were outfitted, they were dressed and everything else, uniforms until the government took them over. And there was two out of four battalions of Tyneside Scottish, and there was one battalion of the Tyneside Irish. And they all came and were stationed here.
That was Joe Pickard. And you can read more from our First World War veterans each month in BBC History magazine. OK, so that's almost all for this week. Please do tune in next time when we'll be joined by Dan Jones and Susanna Lipscomb to discuss the Wars of the Roses. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.